Today's episode is brought to you by Expona 2019. America's premier high-fidelity audio show takes place April 12th, 13th, and 14th at the Renaissance Schaumburg Hotel and Convention Center near Chicago, Illinois. Plan a trip to the Windy City this spring and sample over 190 listening rooms of high-end audio equipment and explore the latest in headphone hi-fi in Expona's Ear Gear Expo. Tickets are available now at Expona.com. That's www.axpona.com. We're back. No, we already did that.
Yeah, no more Aerosmith.
Yeah, no more Aerosmith. I'd have to say the Bees is back. The Bees is back in town.
Bees is back.
The Bees is back.
What's up? Everybody's working for the weekend.
But that's all I was thinking too. Everybody's working for Bees Weekend. Brian Beasley joining us in the intros. How you been? It's been
a little great.
Bit.
How have you been?
I've been at most excellent. I went to Disneyland this weekend.
No, you did not.
Mm-mm. I didn't. I lied.
Did you have fun?
I did.
It was pouring rain. How was that?
It was wonderful. Yeah. I love the rain. Actually,
no lines, right?
It was rain and 60 degrees out. So it's not like rain and 40 degrees or even 50.
Yeah, it's California rain. I get you.
Bees does have some experience to share with him. So if you remember a couple episodes back, we gave Brian...
Cliffhanger.
Whoa.
We gave you a cliffhanger.
Do you remember those old TV shows where they would not play the episodes in sequence? And there would be... They don't do it now. Everything's like very sequential. But I swear when I was watching TV shows as a kid, they'd be like, dun, 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 cliffhanger. But then the next episode, the next week, wouldn't be the follow-up.
Yeah, if it might be a rerun, yeah, you're screwed.
It was horrible. Yeah, because they did a lot of cliffhangers. Thanks for clearing that up.
No worries. My pleasure. Who shot JR? I never found out.
The original story of Bees in the Amplifier starts like this. You went out.
Yep.
You bought...
I didn't even go out. Amazon primed.
Well, he went out mentally.
The cheapest amp I could find.
Like a lot of people, I think, you went out and you were like, okay, I'm going to start my audio journey. He has a pair of sentimental loudspeakers and he needs an amp to run them. Like most people, he's like, you know what? I'm going to go out and we'll just try the most least expensive option out there. And what was that initial experience like, just to rehash it?
We moved into a new house. I finally got my own little space back as a man. I set up my office and all I had in there was my record player. So I just needed an amp with one input. So I found the cheapest $50 amp with one input. The problem became, later on, I was like, I wanted to add things such as my Alexa or maybe my computer or whatever. And it was me constantly unplugging and replugging in different inputs into the tiny little amp. And eventually it just started to suck pretty badly, honestly.
So it basically started to crackle.
Yeah, there's lots of cracks. Anytime I would touch anything on it, volume up and down, the actual like record player sounded like garbage. And even my Alexa would just mute itself, and I thought, oh, what's going on here? Like something's wrong, and it was the amp.
So
I didn't really know how bad it was until Mr. Hunter himself came in and changed my life.
So we came in with the Rega Brio R. It is a 52-channel 50-watt amplifier to replace this atrocity of audiophile gear that he was running with. One of the things people ask me is, why does this stuff cost so much? And the Rega Brio R is not cheap. I believe it's anywhere in the range from used $600 to, you know, brand new when it launched. It might have been upwards of close to $9,000. One of the things at least I can say from this whole scenario is that it is a bit more of a quality instrument in that it has not broken yet.
That is correct. Obviously it was a huge upgrade. The first and foremost, it has more inputs. I can plug everything into it without any issues, but it sounded so much better. As a matter of fact, it makes my speakers sound so much better than they originally sounded. I think even way back when, like there's, especially the bass, the lower end stuff is really coming in. There's a clarity to it that it didn't have before. It's all there. And I was very impressed with it, honestly.
So of course we have like, you know, a jump in quality in terms of the actual build. The thing's a bit heavier, it has more power.
Yep.
It doesn't break initially, but I will say, unfortunately, with this particular unit, before I handed it off to him, I did notice that the actual knob.
Yeah, you told me like, oh, has the knob fallen off on you yet? And I was like, no. And then I went over and touched it and kind of gave it a slight pull, and it did. It popped right off, and I was like, oh, that's not good. But with a little screwdriver, you know, a little eyeglass screwdriver, mm-hmm. I was able to tighten it up pretty good, and I haven't had any issues with that. You know, it's obviously got a volume knob, but then to change from the four different inputs, it's just a button on the actual machine, and you have to cycle through. And I kind of wish that it had a knob for the channel so that I could just switch back between the two channels that I use instead of having to, you know, go completely all the way around the merry-go-round of inputs.
And on the other side of things, though, it is a 50 watt, so it drives the speakers very easily here, yeah. And it will drive your typical, right?
Yes.
Your typical loudspeaker. Now, we have run this with the ELAC Unify 5 bookshelves, which are a dreadful 4 ohms, and that 4 ohms sucks a lot of juice. And so in that scenario, I would say it's not ideal. It's the 50 watts is not quite enough for something of that nature. But for a lot of applications, drinking, sipping your whiskey in your office.
Yeah, because that's exactly what it is. I mean, I use it when I'm working. I usually play classical music. And then, you know, when I take afternoon meetings in the office, we might pop open a nice bottle of scotch and we can, you know, sit in the leathers and have a cigar, and it's, you know, it's perfect. I'm not disturbing my neighbors or waking up my kids that are asleep down the hall. So, it's absolutely perfect. And it's a nice size too. It's not overly big. It's not too small either, but it's kind of like that nice medium size, and it's perfect for my little bookcase.
And if you have a turntable, input one is actually a phono stage built right in, and a Rega phono stage at that. So there's a lot of fun little perks with this particular amplifier, and I do like to recommend it as an entry-level amplifier for those guys, like in this perfect scenario where you bought something just like, let's get into this thing, and then, it breaks or whatever, and then you want to go to that next level. I'm not saying that this is the end game stuff for audiophiles. I know guys like to go a lot deeper, but this is one of those steps, I think, that you can take into giving yourself just another little bit of sound. Would you say that you...
Oh, 100%. For my price, what I wanted to spend on it, it was perfect. We may move on to bigger and better, but for right now, it's working perfectly.
A couple of Macintosh monoblocks, I think, are up next. We'll just see how that goes from there. Christopher Hildebrand on the show today from Fern and Roby.
Nice.
A nice guy. We go into it a little bit. We go off into the ether, I think, just a touch. We have a very kind of fun conversation about a lot of different things. But he is a man of many geniuses, and he does a lot of manufacturing stuff behind the scenes. And he's also running Fern and Roby, the brand that's creating audiophile products. So... Bees, you want to do the thing?
Yeah, roll it.
Gets she accuses me of being a quiet talker, and when she calls me out on it, when I'm really upset, I start talking quieter, and I want the person to come closer to me so I can tell them something really serious.
I think we're the yin and yang of life right here. I'm classically a loud talker. You guys can't see this, but the gain levels between our two is just like pointing at like opposite directions. And I didn't do the thing that I usually do. Get your name perfectly right. Since we're here, Christopher.
That's about right, yeah.
I just think it was Christopher.
Christopher, yeah. Hildebrand.
Oh, man, it's so easy.
It is so easy, but a lot of people screw it up.
Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Boulder, Colorado.
Nice place. Yeah. I heard it's actually kind of expensive there.
It is now, yeah. But I was we moved there in the 70s, and my whole family moved out in 99, and now we're located in the East Coast. I'm the black sheep.
Christopher, actually, he's a brilliant artist. Artisanal quality from his turntables and loudspeaker now. Are you working on a loudspeaker? Am I supposed to talk about that?
We have loudspeakers. Yeah, you can talk about all you want.
The platters of these things, the textures that you look at, the metalwork. It is next level in terms of visual appeal. It just looks like time and energy went into this thing. And I cannot help but also comment on the way you've looked at your brand, and you've chosen to actually create a brand with a look, and it's not just silver boxes. I don't feel like it is for you. This is definitely a silver box here in front of us, but
it's a nice silver box.
It is a very good silver box. Can you tell me about your brand and just general strokes and how you came up with the name, maybe?
Figuring out what to make took about 4 or 5 years. Our company, Tectonics Design Group, started in 2003, and we've been contract design and manufacturing firm, implementing other people's ideas, interior designers, architects, engineers, manufacturers. And at a certain point, I just realized that I was working for other people's ambitions and not for my own, spending more time looking at spreadsheets and helping people who wanted to work for me, you know, expand and grow. And I wasn't doing the handcraft that I really needed to nurture myself. So I started making furniture. And that was about 7 years ago. I started making furniture after my wife and I built a house. And that really just got me realizing how much I had abandoned the need of the physical craft that I, as a person, just in my core, I need. And so I started thinking about building this brand. And it took me about 2 or 3 years. I wanted it to be about personality. I wanted it to convey thoughtfulness, and I wanted it to have a flow in the sound. And I envisioned it and everything that we develop around the idea of, if you saw the Fern and Roby brand on a storefront, and you would say, that place looks great, I want to walk in there. And then you walk in there and you're like, wow, this place feels great, I want to sit in here, I want to take this home, I want to live here. You know, that's how I basically try to shape my brand, as it needs to, and frankly, all of our products. I don't want any single one thing to overshadow everything else and occlude and eclipse everything around it. I want it to be harmonious and complementary. So really what it came back to get back to, how did the name come about? I wanted things to be meaningful when I named them. I don't want to come up with a name that is nonsensical. So the naming paradigm for me started shaping up around things that were meaningful to me personally. And my grandmothers were really powerful, inspirational characters. They were just great people, smart women, in a period where, you know, they probably didn't have the opportunities to step out as independently. And they had to demonstrate their independence and their strength and their character in their own way. My grandmother, Jane Roby Beadle Hildebrand, her husband was an astrophysicist at University of Chicago, and part of the Fermi lab and part of the Manhattan Project. And my grandma Fern, Margaret Fern Hooper Stickley, she was married to my grandfather, both of them until they died, over 70 years, both families. And my grandfather was a serial entrepreneur, and my grandmother managed all of the financial and relationship things that my Grandpa Joe and his big personality probably needed somebody like that to keep him straight.
It's a fun thing. Grandmothers are great.
Well, one of the real reasons, apart from their steel and their strength and their you know, just spark and vitality, that I felt like they were good symbols for the brand that I wanted to put together, was that they created these lasting households. Mm-hmm. They created and curated and shepherded this family into a happy success. And it's not like all of us were really pushed toward ambitious careers. We were pushed to be ambitious in our lives.
So what is the structure of your family? You have a sister, you said. How many
are Two sisters.
Two sisters?
Yeah.
And
my,
you?
And my folks, yeah.
What are your parents like?
Well, they're great people, too. I mean, they've been married for over 50 years now. Mm-hmm. And my mom's a Episcopal priest. Mm. She was ordained a while ago in her second career. Before that, she ran a nonprofit for people with disabilities and job training, independent living skills, medical support for people. And she grew a nonprofit from about five or six people to over 70. Mm-hmm. And that was in Boulder, where I grew up. And just a really dynamic, strong, intelligent woman who loves reading and coffee and and singing and family. And, you know, that's my mom. And there's always room for somebody else at the table.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's never a crowd, really. And my dad is a sweet, kind man and very funny and caring and great manager. He was the head of Earth Science at Goddard, NASA. So at the end of his career, he had about, I don't know, 1,500 people working under him. And he's a meteorologist. And
like on the TV?
No. And he always used to get mad at us when we'd ask him what the weather was. He'd say, I haven't watched the TV. I don't know what it is. No, he studied tornadoes and, you know, weather forecasting, modeling and mapping of storms and prediction and, you know, the science side of meteorology.
And who was his employer? NASA, you said?
Growing up, he was at NCAR, the National Center of Atmospheric Research.
Oh, okay.
And,
is that based out of Boulder as well?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah, we moved there because he and my mom loved the mountains, and he went there and did kind of like a temporary job, a gig, and went back to Illinois and was like, I want to move here permanently. And then he got himself a job at NCAR. Mm-hmm. And we were there for about 20 years. And then in 98, 99, he moved to NASA Goddard, right outside of D.C., mm-hmm. and got hired to be the deputy director of Earth Science. And most people don't realize this, but the Earth Science part of NASA is several times bigger than the space part of it. And it's a really big program with a lot of science and important stuff that's going on. And he was in that deputy director position for a while and then got promoted to deputy director of Earth Science and Space. But he didn't like that as much. And when the job came up to be the director of Earth Science, he took the demotion to be in there because he was engaging with the people that he really wanted to be.
Did he talk about work much in the home?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I used to go hang out with him at his office and, you know, draw and play with computers and look at science equipment and fascinated with, you know, the radar equipment and the airplanes that they were using. And, you know, I've been surrounded by engineering and science throughout my entire life. You know, there's just a real love of the arts and science. There was never a discussion of there being one type of creativity or another, you know.
That's interesting the way you put that, yeah.
Well, a lot of people, they see what I do and they say to me, I could never be creative. And I'm like, you know what? That is just not actually, it's such a false dichotomy. You know, creativity is solving problems in a particular kind of context. And whether you're sending somebody to the moon or making, a great sandwich, or you're making a musical instrument for somebody or a pair of shoes. The creativity that we experience in our commercial lives and how we build something to take advantage of what we know and how to put food on our plate is all about really tapping into the thing that we do kind of naturally. And we overlap a lot of different things, but happy people tend to pick the things to make a living that their bodies and minds want to do innately. That's something I really firmly believe, is that rather than make a lot of money and force yourself into an environment or a process that you hate. Do something that you love, do it well, and be smart about how to get it to the place where you can actually elevate your value.
Yeah, I mean, wow, that really, really struck me, because I do realize after you said that the idea of being a creative, I worked in the advertising agency for environment for quite some time, and the idea, the word creative means this, and media and account management is that, and the segregation of that idea that you said is totally false. It's totally false. Everybody in account management still has to be creative in how they problem solve, and everybody in media has to be creative in how they do their planning.
And when you have that kind of compartmentalization, it actually makes both people think of the other pejoratively. You know, it's like, oh, they're one of the creatives, or oh, they're just a salesman. I'm a salesperson. I'm a salesman. I'm a businessman. I am artistic. I wouldn't describe myself as an artist with a capital A. I realized that I wasn't going to become Michelangelo, you know, learning carved marble, and that wasn't my future. But I'm settled on designer with a capital D. I can rock that.
I like that. and just to be, you know, honest about the creativity in the sales side now, most salespeople I know, they are creative as hell when it comes to words. You know, there is a creativity there to talk to people, to salespeople, that he's like, yeah, they may not be making things creative, but they word craft like masters, the best ones, you know. So it is there. I really like that idea that the binary sense of separating out creativity from the rest of us is false. It's not really, it's just compartmentalizing jobs in such a way that's like one thing or the other. But I am totally guilty of that as well, because I for sure in my life I've said I want to do something that's creative and not something that is totally corporate or these types of things, and I've made choices in my life to be closer to that. But that's why I think that statement was so important to keep in mind, that there is creativity everywhere. It's just, are you tapping into it? Are you feeling it? Are you exploring it? And are you growing with it?
Yeah, and I actually think that careers are usually mixed bags. So, you know, you having a job, whatever it is, whether it's your own company or not, and finding 100% satisfaction all the time is unrealistic. You know, it's you have to get through hard, dry periods in creativity. Sometimes you just can't get it out, and you feel like you're done, and you don't want to do it anymore. And then you have a flash, and you kind of you move past something. You transcend that moment of kind of a desiccated, I can't do this anymore. And then suddenly it gets energized again. Mm. So, I, as an employer, I work really hard to try to provide a fertile field for my staff to grow and to execute. But there's a lot of production that goes into it. You know, there's a lot of execution and skill and craft and expertise that only comes with doing it over and over and over and over again. And that's what tradecraft is. When we say artisanal, it's not I'm making a different cheese every time. It's making the same damn cheese for your entire life, you know, and that you become known for that special cheese or oysters or whiskey or whatever. And sometimes you're probably like, man, I don't want to drink this beverage that I've become known for, but that's your craft. That's the thing that you've built. There's a pride in it. There's a something that gives you stiffness in your posture. Mm. And if you don't have that continuity in your life in some form, you're really missing something. You know, you're just being a tumbleweed, you know, jellyfish. So I try really hard to give my staff and my company form and shape and structure, but allow for flexibility and you know, transcendence from one compartment to another. Mm. And that's what I always try to bring people with me when we do a show. Mm. And I want the people who are designing and making the things that we make to enjoy seeing the people appreciate it and enjoy it. And that's a big part of our brand, is real people making real things, and we're interacting with real people who are buying those things and using them, and they're buying something that they care about that has connection to other people who are living their lives and making things for a living.
What was the first kind of thing that you were inspired to make in terms of Fern and Rumpy? What was the first product?
It was a coffee table. And then I made several other tables. I really started thinking about what was an essential tool, you know, essential kind of piece of hardware for your life. And a table was like the thing that you work at, that you commune with your friends and family, and that you negotiate over, that you spread out and plan at, that you know, it's just the primary tool for everybody in life, and that felt like a really powerful thing to work on.
And then, so you released tables, furniture. When did you decide that you needed to grow your business into the audiophile realm? What was the first thing you wanted to make in terms of audio?
I was led into it. In a way, it kind of felt somewhat random, but it was relationship basis. I had a friend that ran another manufacturing business, and he was getting into music, and he asked me to help him make a DIY loudspeaker. We have CNC routers, and he wanted me to help him make this, you know, horn loaded speaker. And wow. I honestly, looking back on it, I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah, you're my friend. Of course I'll help you. And I hadn't even realized yet that I had left music out of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up playing instruments. I learned how to play the banjo, guitar, and mandolin. Mandolin pretty poorly, but I try, you know. I would never describe myself as a musician, but I've always admired musicians. And so I like to scrape at the stringed instruments sometimes. And so my friend Jamie asked me to help him with this speaker, and I had a couple of extra drivers. He was like, you know, if you want to make one for yourself, you can. I actually wasn't really too interested in it, and it just sat in my office, the drivers on a pile of cube-shaped blocks of wood that I had made, these solid pieces from beams. And they were just sitting there, and I was working really hard, and they were in there for about 3 months. And then one day I was just kind of taking a mental break from looking at these spreadsheets and crunching numbers, and I kind of turned around, and I just absorbed this image of these things together for a while. And I've been hearing Jamie talk about music, and I came back and I like just turned to it, and I just, in my mind, I just kind of saw this super imposition of this driver onto this cube of wood. And it was so essential in its form and shape and simple, and it was a full range driver. And I was like, man, it would be really cool, just, you know, make a little bookshelf speaker. And it felt doable because there was no like crossover, there was no like I have to figure all this stuff out, but it was something I could make that would be simple and good, and I felt like I could make something that would contribute something interesting to the brand. And that was really that moment where I was like, this is cool. And I started looking back at what I was doing with music, listening, enjoying it. And I realized I just let it atrophy and die. And some of that was I was filling my bucket in a different way with my business, trying to get it to succeed. And I was, you know, newly married. I built a house. I was being creative in other ways, but sometimes you can spend too much time being creative and not enjoying enough of other people's creativity. And getting back into music has really been about recharging myself and hearing and appreciating other people's art. That's kind of the start of it. And then Jamie, the owner of the foundry, asked me to make a turntable out of cast iron. And I was like, hell yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was getting into, actually. But
the first product that you kind of did and came to the show was the turntable, right? Because you were showing with someone else's speakers. Is that correct?
No, actually the very first product that I made to go to an audio show was the beam speakers, the two-ways.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the cube speakers were something that I was really excited about, and they were really cool, but my audiophile buddies kind of, they didn't really get it, you know? It was just like checked beam, had cracks in it, even though I'd sealed it, and, you know, they were like, the air's going to get out of it. Mm. And I was like, who cares? You know, like, I seal it, and they're like, this is weird. You need to paint it piano black. And I was like,
that is true. I'm sorry. That is true.
I was like, no, absolutely not. No, I'm not painting it piano black. You know, it's not going to have chrome on it either. And it's like, I was just doing my thing, and I was in a place where I was feeling really rebellious about my creativity with the brand, because I'd been implementing other people's ideas for so long, so I just didn't want to hear anybody's feedback about it. I just was like, this is my sweet jump.
Very Apple of you.
So but I felt like I needed to do something, and these guys were helping me figure it out. So my friend Tim Stinson and Dave DeLand, who's now my general manager, Dave started giving me records, and I didn't even have a record player yet, and I bought myself a Soda Star Sapphire. And it was the closest high quality audiophile grade table that still kind of had a touchstone to the nostalgic turntable that I remembered playing and listening to records on, my dad's. And so I was really stoked about that. Tim helped me with the crossover. We selected drivers, and then we argued about the size, because I wanted to use this beam of wood and split it in half, and I couldn't make the beam grow. I had to buy it. What was there, you know, a salvage beam. And so there was limitations to what I could do, and I just couldn't make it bigger. I couldn't make it narrower. It was like I was cutting it in half, machining it out, and gluing it back together. And so there was a lot of learning about, well, what does an audiophile want?
It's a solid piece of wood that you hollowed out?
Yeah. Yeah, so we...
I mean, to me, we live in a land of MDF here, and to hear you talk like that, it sounds like heresy. Even, like, the really, really high-end stuff still uses, like, I forget what the term is, like, FMDR, harder or bigger or denser FDR, but every time I ask that question, in the back of my mind, I'm always like... Tell me you did it from a solid piece of wood.
I did it from a solid piece of wood.
And these guys, the answer is always like, it's MDFR or whatever. It's never from a solid piece of wood.
Well, there are a lot of challenges with that.
Yeah, no, I mean,
I mean, apart from finding the right piece of wood without checks, and it's select wood, wood by its nature expands and contracts. Yeah. So you've got to really plan how you're going to build something if you're going to break mold and get out of an engineered material. But I found really nice material, and I made the first pair of beam speakers 2 weeks before the show, and I was putting the finish on before I drove up to the Capitol Audio Fest, and that was my very first show.
And what was your impression of the show? I mean, you kind of only saw it through the window of your room, I'm assuming, that time, but how did your expectations of what you were going to see differ from what you actually saw?
Honestly, at that point, I was just deeply skeptical, and, like, people spend all this money on this stuff, and it really felt self-oriented in many ways when I was walking around, and it wasn't outward-facing, and I think the American audiophile market, it has really done this to itself. It's really focused on designing and building things for engineers. You know, it's engineers designing as if they are the target market. They're not paying attention to what the greater public wants. In fact, they disparage that. And then there's a crying about how we can't get more people into it. Well, we've done this to ourselves here. And if you want to attract a broader, larger audience, you have to pay attention to what they want. And if you want to make great sound, it doesn't need to be a compromise to have it look good. And that is the false dichotomy that's always driven me nuts, is that when I first entered into this, nobody in the community they were all like, what, you must be a lifestyle brand. And I was like, well, aren't you? No, I do hi-fi. I'm about quality of music, you know. And I was like, I love good music. I love great sound. I have an engineering background. I I am an artisanal craftsman. I love design and I love making things. I just don't want to make it like everybody else is making it. I want to make it in a way that I find exciting, and I want to do it in a way that would attract a larger audience, and fit into a home, and men and women would like it, and kids would think it was cool. You know, it's like, why does it have to be so singular in terms of the focus? And so I've been trying to manage that and thread that needle for the last 4 years, is how do I make things that are relevant for this industry and straddle over into the larger home furnishings market and the real people living in the real world that want something that sounds great. They want vinyl, but they want a great system, but they don't want to have to figure out what part goes with what and what component is going to sound good with this component. And, you know, I've gone completely down the rabbit hole. You know, I mean, I've made a three-way horn system with an active crossover and direct amplification and you know, multiple turntables, and I've designed and built my own phono preamp. So everything is separate. But my first integrated amp in partnership with somebody else was an integrated amp. It was small. The idea was small, discreet, attractive, interesting, unpretentious, you know, complementary to the rest of the stuff around it. But it had to deliver excellent quality. And the engineer I was working with, his name is Mike Bettinger. He now works for VPI. Just a terrific engineer, great ear, and he's been making and fixing audio equipment for years and years. And, you know, we made something. We sold 5 of those integrated amps in the first year. But it, you know, it just wasn't, we didn't get enough steam with that product, and he needed to move on. So that's, he moved over to VPI. And you know, that was actually the point where I met Linear Tube Audio. So David Burning's been doing crazy stuff, ZOTL tube amps, you know, for a really long time. He's a physicist and a really great, funny, creative guy. You know, again, creativity, physics, yeah. You know. And Mark Schneider, the owner of Linear Tube, he took on the task of basically taking David's really elaborate, complicated to manufacture, but elegant and simple designs, and has been working to deliver a manufacturability, a product that is actually more affordable. And his initial effort with the chassis and casework was really to go simple and affordable, so that he could keep it, the sound and the quality, affordable. And it had a lean, kind of muscular, simple style and aesthetic. But it was so Spartan that it almost looked like a piece of lab equipment, which I think can be really cool on its own. But he had received some feedback that it would be nice to have casework that was a little more detailed and refined, had more style to it. I really actually object to that idea. That wouldn't be my own term. That's like the separation between creativity and not creativity. Yeah. Everything has its own style, whether you're wearing, you know, your underpants over your jeans or not. That's a style too. So they asked me if I would design and build chassis for them, and it just seemed like a really awesome opportunity to work with such a great team, Mark and David, and then have something of my own to be able to contribute to the success of that. And we have 9 CNC milling machines, and we had a team of talented designers and craftsmen, and we do some sophisticated manufacturing on our own. So for the last year, we've been working on repackaging and redesigning the presentation of this brand of theirs. I mean, that's been an interesting challenge because it's their brand, not mine.
Which brand is that?
Linear Tube Audio.
Oh yeah, yes.
So, you know, my goal there was to actually develop and deliver a logical extension of their work, mm-hmm. That delivered also some of my own stylistic moves, my own interest, and So it really kind of came down to my own take on a black box, mm-hmm. with capacitive brass buttons and a dot matrix LED display. But instead of having it forward, we drilled holes through the solid chassis. So when it's off, you just see this nice, sleek array of holes.
Wow.
The finish is black anodized aluminum, but we basically hone the finish before we anodize it. And then Scotch-Brite it afterwards. And so it has this beautiful kind of soapstone look, honed soapstone. I'm happy with it. It's interesting. It's of myself, but it's not Fern and Roby, but it's complimentary. So it's like I got to help somebody make something that I want to buy for myself. Yeah. So that's been great, but it's another kind of intersection between different types of creativity. And, you know, Mark's creativity is being able to coach a team into manufacturing these complicated things here in the United States and train people who had never known how to build amplifiers before. And there are these, I mean, like the amount of twisted wires and handwork in these amplifiers is insane. And when people talk about how affordable his stuff is, they just don't even realize the deal and the value that they're getting. They're getting burning design. They're getting the craft of building these things that Mark's team is doing. And Mark is doing it because he loves it, you know, and that's his creativity, is kind of engineering a process to make this complicated thing affordable. And that's wonderful. I'm just so thrilled to be working with him. And David's fantastic. Like I said, he's hilarious and brilliant and really generous. So I'm very fortunate to be surrounded by creative people of different stripes.
Since I've been doing this, I've learned that there's, in the bigger companies at least, when it can be afforded, such a dynamic difference between industrial design and then the acoustic designers. I was lucky enough to go to the Macintosh World of Macintosh in New York, and I met with the designers of two of their new flagship speakers, and there was the industrial designer and then the acoustic designer. And when I asked them if you could overcome any, you know, obstacle in terms of like material or whatever obstacle in your design, what would you do to make the best speaker? And this guy's like, get rid of the industrial designer.
Well, that's unfortunate, because I actually think that the richest collaboration and the is when you and your collaborator is and your peer and your partner in design and creativity, when you really get each other and you're in that moment of tension between means and methods,
yes.
and inspiration and certainty about your thing being right. But the leveler on all of this is, who is it for? What do they want? How much are they going to perceive the value of it? So if you kick product viability out, and that's not a central tenet of the industrial designer and the acoustic engineer and the business owner, you're going to have a product that is going to fail. And you're not going to succeed with hi-fi because you're not going to care about success. Success is making your clients happy. And if they don't know that they're missing something because they've never seen or heard it before, it's your obligation to educate them. If you don't understand that there's a gap in the market and that you are not paying attention to it, you're only designing for yourself, you should go back to your garage.
The same could be said, unfortunately, for so many musicians I feel in life that I've met. There are a slew of people you've never heard of, never seen, that only play for themselves. And I think there is a time and a place for that, but when your band starts to grow out of that and you start to perform for people, I think there's a certain obligation to produce things that aren't just completely masturbatory. And there's a lot of folks out there that's a shame because they're great musicians and this thing, but they lose sight of that and they can't grow to the next level. They're limited by their own short-sightedness in that. But it's not about sacrificing everything that feels good while you're playing the instrument for you know, selling out for pop music or to make money. I just think that there is, without limits, it's almost the opposite for creativity. For example, Jack White used to say that when he wrote some of his greatest stuff, he would limit to things by the number of three. Three instruments, three whatever. He used limitations to inspire greater creativity. Without a certain amount of squeeze, you're not going to get any juice.
I think that's totally right. And if you don't have discipline and structure and an acknowledgement that the opportunities for true authorship and true creativity that's new and fresh, if you think you're going to go change the world, you know, in this day and age, and you know, with your new idea, good luck with that. What the changes that we make in the creative moments that we have as designers and engineers are on the backs of millions of other people before us. And so what you really have most of the time is the craft and building your trade craft and your knowledge that's based off of all of these other people. And then you have moments of insight. And that's where the true creativity is. And the real true creativity, in my opinion, is this moment where you are making connections between things. You're seeing something that is taking two concepts and you're saying, oh, there's something that's bridging this. There's an opportunity to do something fresh and interesting with how these things go together. And so when you say, or Jack White said, I'm going to limit things to threes, what he's really talking about is he's talking about managing the creativity in between a limited number of things and talking about the dialogue between those three things. And that's absolutely right. You know, trying to be creative with 1,000 things at once is a good way to make mud. So you want to be razor sharp and you want to be focused and you want to deliver a cohesive message. You really have to choose your content and choose your tools and your canvas carefully.
So what, in terms of your next project, do you think, what direction are you looking to go? Where do you want to explore? What's left for you?
I'd like to learn how to bake some really good French bread.
Oh, dude. I like a hard crust, but if it cuts your mouth, I always get in a bad mood.
Mm.
Like it's got like texture in bread, in the French bread at least, is so key. If you nail that down,
yeah,
it's everything.
What's my next audio project? I would, you know, I've been exploring all of this crazy esoteric audio, this hi-fi, and I love it. But I'm really honing what I'm learning, and I'm starting to steer back to this place of what do I want to do for the larger market? My goal is, how do I hammer this price down? How do I deliver something that is ironclad, that's a tank, that is easy to operate, you know, that you could drop. It would be okay. That is like, it's going to sound good when you plug it in. You know, it's like, how can you make it so that the usability of the person that doesn't want to become an audiophile can get the quality of an audiophile experience, and that normal people will have a chance at aspiring to get it. You know, they might have to save a little bit, but driving the cost down on something, getting to something where you know with certainty that you've made something really good and you know you've made something that the larger market's going to want and you've got the credentials to say, yeah, that guy knows what he's talking about. He's making something really valid. And when you get to that place where people are like, yeah, he's going to make something good. They are going to make something good. That brand understands something. Then the company can have the confidence to make 1,000 of them. And when you make 1,000 of them, you're employing what Henry Ford did, which is good engineering and process, good investment in infrastructure, smart engineering in tooling, and acquisition of materials where you're certain you're going to get the ROI and you know you're going to take your stab at it. You're going to put your cards on the table and you're going to make that bet. And you're going to seek to drive the cost down and increase your margins at the same time because you have certainty about the quality of it. That is the big goal. Stop making a business model where you plan on selling 10 of something, but move to 200 turntables or 500 turntables and make them yourself. Because with vertical integration and taking care of your people, paying good salaries, providing benefits, it can all happen if you have a plan and if you have certainty that you're going to be able to sell the stuff and you engineer it and you develop it. You know, automotive industry does it all the time.
It's so interesting that you bring up that number again, because I've heard that exact, the $1,000 run as the goal for companies that are starting so many times. Just say, well, what's a typical run, or what's the minimum run, or what do you shoot for? Like, when they're coming up, it's a grand. It's like, we need to do a grand. If I can do the grand, it'll be the thing.
You know, we have a lean manufacturing model ourselves, and we're practiced at doing that for our clients. We have our own sweet spots. I've had runs that I've done for clients that are 17,000 piece orders. By the end of it, I just, my staff is fatigued. You know, it's like, if you only have a 17,000 piece order and you're never going to do it again, you don't get the benefit of figuring out how to do it the one time. And then you can't employ the other processes to make it painless down the road. If you're doing, you know, 100,000 pieces and you're doing 10,000 pieces per order, then you can invest in the process to make it less onerous and make it easier and make it more profitable. So it's about repeatability. It's about owning a process. It's about knowing that you're going to have the work down the road. And that's the beautiful thing for me with Fern and Roby, is that it's mine. I have control over my own client. I have the ability to have my hands on the levers to grow the company, and that's good for Tectonix. It's good for our manufacturing company. And when I work with somebody like Mark from Linear Tube, and my name is on the back of the chassis, and my brand is being used to market it, and I'm selling it as a dealer, I know that I benefit when I put effort into growing it. I have visibility out into the market. So we just dovetail all of these other small jobs in. And sometimes we're doing 25-piece runs, sometimes we're doing 100-piece runs, but it doesn't matter if you're orchestrating the flow through the shop. And that's where 9 CNC machines and 6 guys can do $1.5 million worth of work.
One of the things that was brought to my attention this week was that one of the high-end turntable manufacturers was saying, you know, if we had made only, when they're looking at their cost, the question was, for people who don't have a lot of disposable income, how can a table cost $10,000? That's what I proposed. And he said simply, for this run, if we had only produced 10 turntables, we would have lost a ton of money. That they have to pack in the variability of the cost. Have you ever embarked on a project where if you only produced 10, you would have lost lost money?
Yeah, it happens all the time. I mean, but we've been custom design and manufacturing business model for 15 years.
Yeah.
So when I got to start making 10 at a time, I was like, wow, yeah! You know, if I get to make 10 at a time and I'm going to do another 10 next month and I'm going to do another 10 the next month, then I start building fixturing that allows me to put it in. But if you're a manufacturer who actually doesn't do the machining in-house,
yeah,
then you have to basically pay for that fixturing and amortization of the fixturing and the setup and the programming every time you hire that person. And if you are chasing lower numbers and making people compete, every time those manufacturers, those machinists, those sheet metal manufacturers are making a bet that you're going to go back to them and use them again and again. And they lose a lot of money when they don't get to repeat it. Because there's an engineering expense to doing a job for the first time. And so being a really good client of another manufacturing firm means being predictable and coming back and saying, you know what, this didn't go right, but I'm not going to leave. We're going to engineer this process together and we're going to get to know each other. I'm going to learn your flow chart. and who your people are, and we're going to get through this. We're going to straighten it out, and then I'm going to be a really good client for you, and you're going to make money, and it's going to be easy, and you're going to know who I am, and you're going to know you're going to get more orders, and I'm going to know that you're going to do it right, and we just need to communicate. And that's hard. It's hard work to manage your own staff. It's hard work to manage somebody else's staff. But to do a complicated thing like making consumer electronics is impossible to do it all in-house unless you're an enormous vertically integrated firm. So you have to really be a good manager to pull it off. And if you're small and you're doing it artisanally and creatively, then you really have to be managing good relationships. And that's what the best people here that are doing this that I know do, is that they have loyalty to their vendors, their relationships, they trust them, their vendors trust them in return, and they're building some business together in that way. And, you know, we have more vertical integration than most audio manufacturers, but we still rely upon our close relationships with our subs.
What are your thoughts on 3D printing as it kind of applies to turntable design?
I actually made my first 3D printed product recently. I got some ETI RCA connects, interconnect, and I'm using smaller, these are from my tone arm, so I was using my tone arm cable, and my tone arm cable was like a 1/16 of an inch with four conductors, and it's really small. It's not typical for RCA, and the gap, it had set screws in it, so I was love the connector, but I didn't like the strain relief and the cable management. And so I looked at it, and I could turn it and mill it and wire EDM what I had in mind, which was basically something that tapered down the larger size barrel down to a smaller size for the cable, and had some ears that the set screws could push on so that the set screws wouldn't bite into the cable because the tone arm cable was so fragile. And I looked at it, and I was like, man, if I could make this, but it would be crazy. And I've been really watching 3D printing and waiting for the moment where I could say, you know, this is getting real. Because people ask me all the time, do you 3D print? And I'm like, no, we do 3D machining and subtractive machining and manufacturing, advanced manufacturing. We do 3D scanning, some pretty advanced stuff. But 3D printing as a work platform is still finding its footing. There's a lot of pioneers in it, and you know they're expensive machines, the ones that actually produce valid, real, competitive product. You want to buy a really good 3D printing metal printer, you're talking $500,000 or something like that, and you run it, and you run the whole build box, and if you don't fill the build box, you still spend the same amount of money to run it. And it's the same thing with the other types of material 3D printing. So you're going to buy a $250,000-$500,000 machine, you're talking about, you know, $6,000, $10,000, $12,000 a month in overhead just to run it. And then you need the person, you need the software, and you're talking about $20,000 a month for a machine. And conventional machining has a little bit of pain up front to get over the hump and make something, but once you get into it, it goes really fast. But when I had the idea for this part, I looked at it and I was like, there's too many steps, and I'd have to get into the fixturing was too complicated, and I didn't know what I was going to do and how many they would be. And I had been talking to a vendor who also sells the services to people that don't have the business to buy it yet. And I said, hey, can you print this for me? I have this idea. I spent a couple hours designing it. And it had barbs in it, so it fit into the shape right. That, and I made serrated teeth on the ears that would push on the cable. All of that would be really hard to machine. And it had flexible flaps internal to this barrel, and it would be really hard to make that conventionally. So I called him up and I said, hey, can you make me some samples? I'd like 20 of them. And he was like, half an hour later, he said, yeah, I got it into the build. I'll get them to you on Thursday. And then I asked him, I was like, so how much will this cost me? It's like $7 a piece. And there was no setup. There's no engineering. There's no nothing. and it fixed a problem for me, and it was really cool and very really valid, and very interesting. So we're getting to a place now where I'm starting to pay attention to how I can use that tool and how I can incorporate it in and add it to our arsenal of equipment and tools. And I would say within the next year, we'll probably start looking at more advanced scanning equipment and 3D printing. We'll get into it slowly, and we'll build a business and use our subcontractors until we have enough of the book of business to actually invest in it. But once we do, then we'll have this great tool.
Plus, you can make really cool keychains.
That
on too. Demand. Think Absolutely. About that.
I just want a little rabbit. Blip,
blip. Everybody who I've talked to on this subject says there's still limits to the size of the the place that you can make these in. So
every single machine is built to handle a certain kind of envelope.
Yeah.
So, and the bigger the envelope, the more media you're using, the more time you're using to run it. And like I said, you kind of start it and then it goes through a run. And so you buy a big machine and you're stuck making big parts. You don't really want to make small parts unless you're making a ton of small parts. And so you buy the machine for the type of business that you've got. And my machine shop does the same thing. We have large vertical milling machines and small ones. Mm-hmm. And I bought a really big one initially. That was my second machine because I didn't know if I was going to be making big stuff or small stuff, so I needed a big machine so I could do both. And then when I got to the point where I grew enough where I needed 3 or 4 or 5 machines, I realized in the workflow that we were doing that we had 90% of our stuff would fit into the small machines, and they cost me less money, and I was able to run 3 of our VF2s at the same time they were running our VF3 and our VF5. And you could put a 1,000-pound steel plate into our VF5 and make pieces for bridges. But you don't need that to make all the small stuff for the turntables and other things. So that all came down to like sizing and engineering the layout of our shop and our business to make it so that my guys can manage more jobs than they could do on their own. So that's where the advanced manufacturing piece comes in, is it's part of why we're able to drive the cost on the Montrose turntable down, is because we've designed it to take advantage of all of the equipment that we have and the talented people that we have. If I was paying other machine shops to make it, I would have to find the machine shop that had the right machine for every single part. Instead, in our design business, we design around the tools that we have, the means and methods knowledge that we have, and then we shape our design process to our advantage. And there's over 60 parts in the Montrose turntable, but they all are made in-house. So when it doesn't fit in-house, I have to look at it and say, am I going to be able to afford this machine that I'd have to buy, or can I find a vendor who can do it better than I can for less? And are they going to be around for a long time? Are they going to want this business? So there's all those questions. Those are the business side, the creative business side, is negotiating and building trusting partnerships.
Yeah,
but also being smart about what tools am I going to buy? You have to go out and decide what microphone you're going to buy, what headphones, what recorder, how can you justify buying certain things, and how is it going to make your life easier? Where is it just ego? Then you need that new microphone.
We're not operating on the big dogs here yet, but we'll get there. Sure, there's a couple of them out there that you see them, and you're like, oh, yeah, that one.
Ooh. Gotta have it.
Gotta have it. There's certain limitations, to this platform that, everything has got to go down to 128 to be to get on the podcasting. Like, it can't be CD quality. So there are certain limitations to the platform, but, yeah. To your knowledge, with the 3D printing, are we getting to the place where we can print materials that are as hard as something you can mill? Is it there yet? Is it close?
Oh, yeah, it's there. Titanium, stainless steel, all sorts of metals. It's just extremely expensive in terms of time and cost, but where it tends to be applied right now is the things that are almost impossible to conventionally manufacture. So some medical device product designs and things where cavities and undercuts and things like, you could actually 3D print a honeycomb of material, a closed cell foam metal structure that was curved and immensely strong and light, and use a teeny amount of material, and it would be impossible to actually manufacture it in any other way. So there are definitely things that anytime you create a new process and a new tool, new ideas and new technology and making materials comes about, and then new designs get evoked from it. So the feedback in industrial design and engineering and material science and manufacturing science is one of those feedback loops that's really amazing. This creativity that comes from inspiration of technology. The technology's not there, but then somebody figures out how to use it, and then the technology grows and it becomes less expensive, and then it gets boiled into the commodity market. And so I'm paying a lot of attention to it because there is a moment where you have to make the right decision to stay relevant in manufacturing. And if you just rest on your laurels and say, well, I've got the process and I know how to make it work, you're going to be a dinosaur before you know it. And if you have great conventional milling equipment or conventional manufacturing equipment, that could stay relevant as long as you keep it relevant. But if you don't get into the advanced piece and you don't stay in the cutting edge in some way or utilize somebody in a smart way that does that, then you're going to find yourself irrelevant.
Can you see a future where you get rid of all your CNC stuff and it's just 3D printed out and out? Is it the future? Is that the next evolution of manufacturing in the world?
I kind of hope not, but I do think...
Why?
That, you know, kind of like Star Trek-y, like... push the button and your soap shows up. I do see a future where stuff like that starts to happen. I'm a huge science fiction fan. I think that a lot of the science fiction writers from the 50s and 60s were very prescient. Brilliant. I mean, I've been reading a bunch of Philip K. Dick recently, and it's just mind blowing and scary the kind of like oppressive media, like culture of like. You know, consume. And he's writing this in the 60s, and there's like floating televisions, you know, and insane stuff. And now I feel like we're surrounded by that. And, you know, cell phones and smartphones and things. Do I see a day where our whiskey is made for us, you know, with a 3D printer? Our clothing comes out of a machine, you know, George Jetson style, you know. I hope not, because... on many levels, it's just like listening to the vinyl. I need that mindfulness. I need that moment of actually working and crafting with my hands. I think having the spiritual side of life is being connected to physicality, and making things is one of the most spiritual things there is, you know. And I think that I don't know. I mean, you got to live life. You got to be connected to things. And I think that if you're having too much done for you, it's too processed, you know, you're just going to eat Velveeta cheese and Weight Watchers and peel and microwave meals. You're not going to have the joy of baking your own bread or cutting down a tree and sawing it and making your own furniture. There is a intense truth to being connected to reality, to being connected to the earth and the planet and the weather and the seasons and survival. And I honestly haven't been watching TV. I haven't been been looking at Facebook much recently, and I've been reading and getting the classics out and listening to vinyl and making things, and I'm happier than I've ever been. You have to let yourself experience and enjoy something. If all of your experience is about tearing things apart and tearing them down, there's never going to be a perfect system. It's always going to be about you showing other people who you are and how good you are by pushing others down. There's so many valid systems in this building right now that are being enjoyed by different people for different reasons. And there is no wrong way to do it. There's just a wrong way to not do it. You know, like you gotta enjoy what you enjoy and let other people enjoy their thing, you know. And I want to enjoy myself, and I want to see other people enjoying themselves. And I want my dialogue with these people and discourse to be about something positive, not about tearing other people apart. I am surrounded by really great people in my collaboration, in my group, and I feel very fortunate in that. So, you know, I just want to say thank you. So, it was a really nice conversation.
Thanks, man. Thanks for coming on.
Sweet.